I have to introduce myself. So there's the title, and it's with Charles Fortin, who was at Waterloo, and now is at McGill University working with Goffin, Michel Louis. So this is a sort of, it's work in progress. This is why Charles has come by, so we can try to finish this work off. And so this may be quite informal. Hopefully you ask lots of questions, and I can get some feedback from you. So this is an idea of what we're looking at, an outline. So I'm just going to go through a little bit of the background of the trust region subproblem and specifically duality. So we're going to be looking at three algorithms, the MS algorithm from 1983, that's Morey Sorensen, 1983, the GLTR algorithm, which is from 1999, and GLTR stands for Generalized Lanczos Trust Region. But interestingly enough, and I don't know if they realize it, the authors are Gould, Lucida, Romana, and Twant. So it's GLTR or GLRT. I really don't know if they realized it. I have to ask them. And then the RW algorithm, which is Rendell-Walkowitz from 1997. And that's the one we're concentrating on, and we're sort of reworking that with some new ideas. And I'm going to concentrate on robustness and exploiting sparsity, looking at large sparse problems. Okay. So here's a picture of what the trust region subproblem is. It's a very simple problem. So we have a quadratic objective and a very simple, very nice norm constraint. So it's just a ball, and it has interior, it's compact convex with interior, nicest possible set we can have. The interesting thing here, of course, is that the matrix A does not have to be positive semi-definite. So this objective function is not convex. And then this is the notation, S is positive, gives us the radius of the trust region ball, and X is the vector of unknowns. So this problem has been studied extensively, going way back in the literature. You can see papers all the way back to early 60s, and probably back, if you really dig, you can go back much, much further than that. So it's used in lots and lots of problems. It's the idea behind regularization of field pose problems, the Konev regularization, adding a ball of this type. Lots of the popular algorithms at the moment, SQP methods, a lot of the other methods, what they do is they add a trust region on it to stabilize the algorithm, stabilize the subproblems, and lots of theoretical applications as well. And the main application is the so-called trust region method for unconstrained minimization. So you build a quadratic model of the unconstrained minimization function F, and the quadratic model is just this Q, so this will be the Hessian. This will be the gradient. We just multiply through by 2. And then you look at the model locally in a neighborhood of the current approximation. And this is where you trust the model. And you go ahead and you solve this trust region subproblem to take the step to the next approximation for the minimum. And then you build another quadratic model locally. And if you do well, you increase the trust region. If you do poorly, you decrease the trust region. So the trust region radius goes up and in, out and in, depending on how well you do. And these methods, what happens is as you get closer and closer to the solution, the trust region radius starts increasing because you're starting to do well. Locally, the quadratic model is quite good. And so the advantage of these methods is that locally, you get second-order optimality conditions, of course, assuming something about the local min. So unlike BFGS methods and these other methods, which only guarantee first-order necessary conditions, we actually get second-order conditions here. So second-order is necessary is guaranteed, and usually, obviously, if the optimum has positive definiteness, then you get the positive definiteness as well. So you get this Q-quadratic convergence because Newton's method takes over asymptotically. So it's a very robust method, and it's used a lot in constrained optimization. But interestingly enough, for the unconstrained problem, most people are still using quasi-Newton methods. And methods such as quasi-Newton methods with the BFGS update is probably the most popular method for unconstrained. And why? Well, because of sparsity considerations. So up until recently, there was no way to really exploit sparsity for these trust region methods. And we'll see why when we take a look at the details of the algorithm. And quasi-Newton methods, well, there are these methods called these limited update methods, and which sort of approximate quasi-Newton updates, which do exploit sparsity, and so they've been much more popular for unconstrained problems. The other interesting thing is this thing called the hard case, which comes up in the trust region subproblem. So I'll mention more about that as well. And so we're going to see that the hard case is really the easy case. Okay, so here's the optimality conditions. Maybe I'll leave the problem up for a little bit longer so you see it. So this is the optimality conditions for the trust region subproblem. So this is very well known since a Sorensen paper and a Gale paper in the early 80s, 83, I think. So this is stationarity. You just take the Lagrangian, you take the objective function, a Lagrange multiplier lambda times the constraint, you take the derivative, and you get stationarity. Now, I've done things a little bit strangely. I've put a minus sign in front of the Lagrange multiplier, which means the Lagrange multiplier is less or equal to zero rather than the usual greater or equal to zero. Okay? So this is stationarity. So the Lagrange multiplier is less or equal to zero. You have primal feasibility and complementary slackness, which says that either you're on the boundary of the ball or the Lagrange multiplier is zero. So these three conditions are usual. This is really is what's surprising. And over here I have the two surprising things over here. First of all is that this is a characterization of optimality because the original problem doesn't have to be convex. And it's interesting that many people, when I've discussed this with them, the first time they see this, they don't even believe it. When I visited Princeton, I had a discussion with Shano. It took a day before he believed this. You know, it seems to be well known, but it isn't. A lot of people don't believe. You have a non-convex problem, and yet you have a characterization of optimality. The global optimum, not the local optimum. And the reason for that is this surprising condition here, which is the second order necessary condition, which usually is on the manifold tangent to the optimal point. Only usually it's a restricted semi-definite condition. Yes? Sorry? Oh, there's a missing square. Yes, it's a square over here. Yeah. Thanks. Or you can remove this S, this 2 over here. Yeah. So usually this is only true on the tangent manifold. And in this case, it's true everywhere. And this is what gives you the characterization of optimality, the fact that this is true everywhere. And of course, by having semi-definiteness, this essentially gives you a hint that maybe semi-definite programming is hiding there. Yes? If you have equality constraints, you get the same result, but you don't need... Okay, as soon as you add two quadratic constraints, the magic disappears. You can have duality gaps. So you don't have a characterization of optimality anymore. So this problem, in some sense, is sitting on the boundary of convex and non-convex problems. You add a second convex constraint, and you can have a duality gap. You mean if the linear term is zero? For homogeneous problems, I don't remember the exact details, but yes, for homogeneous problems, it's different. It's special. Yeah, because one ball will be inside the other, and then only one constraint will be tight. So it's an eigenvalue problem. You just have to find out which constraint works. Yeah. I don't want to swear to it, but there is a special result for homogeneous problems. But all of them have to be homogeneous. the constraints as well as the objectives. Yes. Yes. And that's coming up. Yeah. So, I mean, right now it's sort of hidden mystery why these why you get a characterization. But we'll see that you can transform this to a convex problem. Yes. So, if we take a look at these optimality conditions, this is the way the early algorithms arose and developed. From over here, you see that X star, suppose that you, instead of positive semi-definiteness here, you had positive definiteness, then the optimal solution is characterized by the stationarity here, as long as you have positive definiteness. So this gives you an idea of an algorithm, because then you go and you say, well, X of lambda has to satisfy be feasible. So you've essentially removed the X and made this an equation just in lambda. So you have an equation in one variable only, and you can go ahead and do some sort of root finding on this equation as long as you satisfy this is positive definite. So you can apply Newton's method to this equation or to some variation of it. So this is the idea behind many of the algorithms, and also forms the basis of the algorithm that we're going to be looking at as well. So algorithms in general, one of the things to see is that by doing this, you're looking at lambda, which means it's a dual algorithm. Algorithms in general are dual algorithms. And for us who do a lot of semi-definite programming, we know that dual algorithms do exploit sparsity, usually. However, then there's stability questions, convergence questions. You don't converge as fast, you don't get the accuracy at the end. So I mentioned the hard case. So here's this notion of the hard case. So this says that we know, I'm just going to add this notation here. This is the Moore-Penrose inverse of a matrix, the generalized inverse of a matrix. So in the case the matrix is singular, this is the notion that we're going to look at. So we always have feasibility in the stationarity condition, so this solves the problem in a least square sense. So the easy case is when A, the linear term, is not in the range of A minus the smallest eigenvalue of the matrix times the identity. So this essentially says that A is not orthogonal to the eigenspace corresponding to the smallest eigenvalue. So what does that mean? If A is not in the range of this, it means that lambda star cannot be lambda 1. So if it can't be lambda 1, if lambda star has to be less than lambda 1, and you know at the optimum, you'll have positive definiteness. And this is why this is called the easy case. It's nice when it's positive definite, because then all these things, this equation holds, and you can go ahead and solve this system. Then there's the hard case, what's called in the literature called the hard case, is when this is in the range. Of course, you may not, well, you can always check this if you want to do the extra work. And then the hard case is divided into two cases itself. Case one is when the optimal Lagrange multiplier is less than lambda 1, so you still have positive definiteness. And case two is when lambda star is lambda 1, and in that case, this matrix is singular. So this inverse won't work, and you have to use a generalized inverse. So this is called the hard case, case 2. And this can actually be divided into two cases. One case is when the Moore-Penrose inverse times A is actually equal to the truss region radius. Okay, so that means that the lambda star times dagger A, that means that this is X of lambda star, which is the optimal solution. So X star is the optimal solution, and the optimality conditions are satisfied. However, it could happen that this is less than S. And then it appears that the optimality conditions fail. Yes? Well, that's what you're doing over here, is you're trying to, if this is bigger than S, It can be bigger than S, but if it is, then you haven't found the lambda, the right lambda star, because it, you're going out, you're outside. So you just change lambda star, yeah, because you're trying to satisfy this. So very likely you will be able, if it's bigger than S, you'll be able to use the inverse when lambda star changes. But if it's less than S, it looks like the optimality conditions have failed. However, what you do is you take a Z in the null space, you take an eigenvector, because lambda star in this case is lambda 1, and then you just take a step to the boundary. And this new point satisfies the optimality conditions, and this is really the optimum. Okay? So people have taken a look in the literature, people take a look at this and say, well, here I have a positive definite matrix. I can solve this system. Over here, this is singular. I have a singular system. It's a square singular system. And of course, a square singular system is very hard to solve. You never know if it's exactly singular or a little bit off singular. So it sounds like it's an ill-posed problem. If it's a little bit off, then it sounds like it's an ill-conditioned problem. So in the literature, this has been called an ill-posed problem, the hard case too. And people have stayed away from this and said, well, if we have a problem where it's close to the hard case, we can't get very good accuracy. You know, you're not going to, because it's an ill-posed problem, how do you get good accuracy, right? So that means that if the condition number of A minus lambda star I is very high, we have a very ill-conditioned problem. That's what it looks like. However, that doesn't take into account the norm constraint. Totally ignores the norm constraint. And this is, if you add the norm constraint in, it changes the whole picture, changes the whole idea. So it's not true that if you have a linear system and it's getting close to singular, it's not true that it's an ill-posed problem if there's a norm constraint on the solution. Yes? No, that's not true, actually. The symmetric eigenvalue problem has a condition number of 1. It's the nicest problem that can exist. And the reason for that is that you can find the eigenvalues using householder transformations. So you're using orthogonal transformations, and they're perfectly well conditioned. And so you're doing a finite number of householder transformations to find the eigenvalues. Each transformation gives you a condition number of 1. So the condition number of the eigen problem, finding all the eigenvalues, is a condition number 1, totally well-posed problem. You can find it to any accuracy you like. And so this is in a recent book by Demel. Jim Demel talks about this. So, yeah. And on the other hand, and for the symmetric eigenvalue problem, even finding the eigenvectors is well-conditioned. For non-symmetric problems, that's no longer true. Okay, because for non-symmetric problems, you can have a multiple eigenvalue and a degenerate Jordan block. Maybe this is what you're thinking about. And in that case, you never know. Do I have two multiple eigenvalues, or do I have two eigenvectors and only one eigenvector? And that's an ill-posed problem. So here's a little lemma on how, you know, this gives you an idea of what we're going to do, what we do to handle the hard case. I'm not going to prove it, just to give you an idea. It may even not be that understandable, I'm not sure. Follow it that well. But so this, and of course you don't do a spectral decomposition to solve the problem. Maybe I just remove it, eh? That help? My computer screen is better than this. I can get two windows on that. So what does this lemma say? Well, if we do a spectral decomposition of A, then we could divide A as the sum of three matrices, A1, A2, A3, depending on these conditions. And what these conditions essentially say is that A is, if A is orthogonal to an eigenvector or not. Okay. So what these AI bars are, they just tell you that A is orthogonal to one of the eigenvectors because P is the vector of eigenvectors in the columns. So what does this say? The interesting part of this lemma is that P3, if you have an optimal X star, P3 X star is going to be 0. So it essentially means that if A is orthogonal to any of the eigenvectors, then if you project X star onto that eigenspace, it gives you it just doesn't do anything. There's no contribution. The best way to think of this is if A is diagonal. If A is diagonal, then the A bar just has a 0 in it. And if there's a 0 in it, then the corresponding X star has to be 0 because of the Moore-Penrose inverse types of relationship. Okay. So, and then X star is still optimal if you replace A by A1. So A1 has removed the eigenvectors corresponding to places where the corresponding AI is equal to 0. It's the AI equals 0 which corresponds to the Hart case. So what this says is that if we do a Lantos method to go ahead and find the eigenvalues during an algorithm, we can go and deflate the corresponding eigenvectors corresponding to components where the Hart part exists, and it doesn't really change the problem. We can move the eigenvalues that are causing us a problem, lift them up a little bit, so they're no longer the smallest eigenvalue, and it doesn't hurt us. And so by doing this, the Hart case just disappears automatically during the Lantos process. So this is part of what we do in our algorithm. The other thing, as I mentioned to you, is this whole idea, is the problem ill-posed? And this is what Jin was mentioning. So just to show you, the idea that Jin mentioned, hopefully this appears properly. So I'm saying here, suppose that this is singular, so we have something like the Hart case, and we ask, is the near Hart case still conditioned? Well, you can only have the Hart case if the smallest eigenvalue is less than 0. In that case, what you can do is you can just shift A by the smallest eigenvalue. So the new smallest eigenvalue is 0. The reason you can do that is because if lambda 1 of A is less than 0, you know the optimum is on the boundary of the ball. Okay, because it can't be on the interior, A would have to be positive definite. So you know it's on the ball, so that means that X transpose lambda 1 X has to be S squared, because you know the length of the norm of X. It's on the ball. So you just have to add S squared lambda 1 A, which is a constant. You can add it at the end of the algorithm, as long as you just shift A along the diagonal this way. What does this do? It changes this problem to a convex problem. And this is what Yin mentioned. In this case, it's a positive semi-definite objective function. You can make it even positive definite if you like and shift it even more. But Slater's condition is satisfied for this problem. And if you write down the dual, we'll see the dual. Slater's condition is always satisfied for the dual. So we have a primal and dual problem where Slater's condition is satisfied. The feasible set is convex compact. What better problem can there be? Is there a more stable problem than Slater's condition and a convex compact set? And we'll also see that strict complementarity holds. So we're all set, right? Because if strict complementarity doesn't hold, then you just solve the unconstrained problem. So they're really, and of course that's not surprising because this is used in regularization processes. So it would be very strange to have a regularization process that results in a Hart case and in something which is an ill-posed problem. So unless I'm mistaken, these problems are nice and stable. So this is the idea of the Morey-Sorensen algorithm. using some sort of heuristic, I won't go into the details, they get an interval of uncertainty for the optimal Lagrange multiplier. And then they implicitly solve this equation. So this is x of lambda over here. And they maintain positive definiteness. They use safeguarding to maintain positive definiteness. So this is always positive definite. And the interesting thing that they do is that the hard case, the possibility of the hard case means that x of lambda is inside the ball. If they're inside the ball, then they take a primal step to the boundary. So this is very similar to some of these algorithms by Yin Yu and these other people on using dual methods for these low-rank semi-definite programs, where they use a dual algorithm, and then they go ahead and then they approximate from the primal side. So this idea is goes way back to their original paper, 1986, I said, right? So it's an old idea, and it works quite well. But unfortunately, this step to the boundary, the information that you get from it is totally lost at the next iteration. It's just something that you do to hope to stop early. So you go to the boundary in this way, and if you've reached your optimality condition, then you know you're there, and you stop. And I'll show you a few tests that we've done, and they have a hard time getting high accuracy in their algorithm. So here's another interesting thing that Morey Sorensen do. So this is something that happens for interior point methods as well, something that's sort of hiding implicitly when people look at do interior point methods, primal dual interior point methods. If we take a look at this equation that I said that they solve over here, and we go ahead and we do a diagonalization and do a Taylor expansion for this, then we see that it's approximately a constant divided by lambda 1 of A minus lambda plus another constant D. Okay, so this is a local approximation. So if lambda, the Lagrange multiplier, is close to the smallest eigenvalue, this is a very nonlinear function. And Newton's method on a highly nonlinear function is going to be very slow. So this is a common technique that people do. Instead of just applying Newton's method blindly, if you have a linear function, Newton's method is going to converge in one iteration. So you try to make your function as linear as possible, if you can, before you start. And what they do is this interesting transformation. They take this function. You could put squares here, for example, to give a similar argument. This function is easy to differentiate, has a constant here, looks nice. And they do this strange transformation. And this is based on some work in approximation theory by Reinsch and Hebden, separately, independently. They take the reciprocal over here, because if you take a look at this function and do an approximation, the lambda 1, which is at the bottom, comes to the top. So instead of working on the reciprocal, it's in the numerator, and of course, this is almost linear. And if you take a look at pictures, you see exactly that happening. You end up having a function which is almost linear. So Newton's method will fly on this near the optimum, especially if lambda is close to lambda 1. So then the constant in the linear is even smaller. And also, it's a convex function, strictly increasing, so it's a really nice function. And then they have some other interesting things that come out. How do they find the derivatives? Well, I'm not going to go through the details, but this is how they do the derivatives. They take the Cholesky factorization of this positive definite matrix, and here's the Cholesky, and then they do this double step with the Cholesky to get these constants, and then to get this y over here, and then the step, the Newton step, is found in this simple way. So the calculation for the derivatives involves the Cholesky. So while they're solving this system with this matrix, they get the Cholesky factor. The Cholesky factor gives them the derivatives as well, and it's very nice in this nice way. So the Cholesky factorization is essential in their algorithm. So that's one of the drawbacks, because I mean, now there's a lot of development being done for large sparse Chilesky. So you can go to much larger problems. But if you have any, if you have a good number of dense rows, the Chilesky is going to be a bottleneck. And this is the bottleneck in their algorithm, is that they're stuck with the Chilesky. And this was what prevented this algorithm from being exploited for large sparse problems, is because of the Chilesky factorization. So this is what the function looks like. So you can really see why it's called a secular function. You can see why you get the fast convergence. You get this nice convex function. So if you start over here, your next point is going to be over here. And then you take a tangent here, you can see that you're almost there in two iterations. Very, very fast. Okay? But this is, that's if you start on this side, right? You have to guarantee, how do you, you can't always start on that side, because from here to here is the smallest eigenvalue. The lambda min will be out here somewhere, and this is, you know, a lambda star is over here. So you have to start somehow between lambda star and lambda min. If lambda star is close to lambda min, how do you find it? How do you get, how do you know you're close enough? Okay? When do you know to stop? The other point is, so what if you start on this side? If you start on this side, this flattens out here, and this is typical. If you start over here, you can see that the Newton step is, may take you way over there. In other words, the Newton step really is giving you garbage. Okay? It's really poor. So what do? That's when they do their safeguarding. They backtrack to get back and stay positive definite. And then they get more information on the smallest eigenvalue while doing this, so it's not a waste of time, but still, the Newton step is really wasting time here. And of course, the reason for this is that we know from semi-definite programming that they're nowhere are they using this constraint in the Newton direction, right? And nowhere are they using the constraint that lambda has to be less or equal to zero. So this information has disappeared in the Newton direction. So it's not surprising that it goes way out there. The complementary slackness for this doesn't appear, and neither does the constraint anywhere at all. So there's no reason to try to get drawn away from the boundary of this being positive semi-definite. And you see that. So many times for the near hard case, when it's hard to find the point on this side, you have many, many, many 30, 40, 50 iterations before you can actually get close. Okay. So this is one of the drawbacks of this algorithm. So this is their little lemma that they have for handling the hard case. It's a bit technical, but the idea, remember, if you remember the optimality conditions, I expect everybody to memorize every transparency and remember it thoroughly. So in the optimality conditions, there was an eigenvector that you needed to take a step from the interior to the boundary. Well, this Z here plays the role of that eigenvector. Of course, there may not be such an eigenvector, but if you can find an approximation to it, and you'd use the Chilesky to find an approximation to it, so that this sigma is small, if you can do that, then you're very close to optimal. So they use the Chilesky and a Linpack routine, which approximates, finds an approximation for this vector, and then if they get a small sigma, then they stop. But of course, this is a heuristic, and this is why they have trouble getting high accuracy. This is one of the reasons, because this is their only way of stopping.
What applications do you need high accuracy?
Yeah, that's a good question, yeah. And for the trust region algorithm, so one of the philosophies that I, when I learned about unconstrained minimization or just constrained minimization in general, is start off with a good direction, expend a lot of energy on the direction, expend very little energy in the line search. So this is one of the axioms, I think, that's around. And one of the things that shows that is Newton's method, right? Newton's method is much more expensive than steepest descent. But of course, if you can't find Newton's method accurately, then you use some approximation to it. and you find that these inexact Newton's methods, where at the beginning you don't need much accuracy, and at the end you have to improve the accuracy, get more and more accuracy. So I think this is a similar phenomenon here, just if we're talking about just the unconstrained problem, that at the beginning you really don't need very much accuracy, just like in Newton's method in general. Okay. At the end you may need the accuracy to make any headway, or else you're going to be using steepest descent. Now, if Newton's method is taken over as you get close, then that phenomenon may not happen. So you're right. So this is a question, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is just one of the things I was just wanting to bring up in general, is do we want an algorithm which works even 99% of the time, and then somebody, 3 years down the road runs into a problem and it fails? Or do we want something robust, right? So that's a good question. So I got a brand new computer, last week, brought her home, a Windows machine, and within 3 days, I had to bring it back. The Windows operating system ended up having to be totally wipe out the hard drive and start over again. So the front end for Windows, I got Windows 2000. The front end had all this new music and all this beautiful stuff, all this brand new help and everything, but it died in 3 days. Right? So that got me to thinking, maybe robustness is a good phenomenon, And also, the IKES program in MATLAB. I think we discussed this at lunch, right? And the IKES program in MATLAB is fantastic, right? But we've been running, Charles and I, thousands of tests with this, and we use IKES. And we died a couple of times, So we're not sure if it's, if it's the algorithm or the theory itself, but, so, I don't know. It's a good question. But not only unconstrained minimization, there are other applications for the trust region cell problem. So where do you need the high accuracy? We're still looking for a very good application. But even medium accuracy is hard to get with these algorithms. Just going beyond 3 decimals is something that these algorithms have to really work for, and they don't always get it. For the large case, I guess Morrie Sorensen did succeed most of the time. So the next algorithm I'd like to look at is, though it's not chronological, this is 1999. We're going to go back to the 1997 algorithm. So this is this method, the GLTR or the GLRT. And it's a Lanczos-based method. So it's a method designed for large sparse problems. So again, as I mentioned here, because of the dependence on the Cholesky, it's very hard to get to very, very large problems. So if you go, the Cholesky, if you've got quite a few dense rows and you go past 20,000, it's going to be very hard to solve on the machines we're working on. So this method here, the GLTR, what it does is it takes the trust region subproblem and it restricts it to a Krylov subspace. So this is a finite dimensional subspace. Obviously, we're in finite dimensions, but it's a subspace of Rn, and it's built up using the iterations from a conjugate gradient method. So it's a Krylov subspace using Krylov subspace vectors. So this is an outline. So no, we're not assuming A is positive definite at all. No. But so the reason that you can do this is that so you go ahead and you apply the conjugate gradient, and as soon as you have problems because of positive definiteness, you're going to jump to the boundary. And as soon as you hit the boundary, you stop. Okay, so as soon as you hit the boundary, you stop, and you solve the subproblem. So this is the first iteration. And then you keep building up the subspace using the usual A to the power times A, the conjugate gradient type of iterations. Okay. So it'll be the span of this. So even though you're using conjugate gradient method, so they use a translation which changes the conjugate gradient directions to the Lanczos directions. So there's a standard transformation that you can do. So what they're doing is, by doing this, they're getting a tridiagonalization of matrices. So the purpose is, even though they don't have positive definiteness, the purpose is to get the tridiagonalization. So they're solving a subproblem where the matrix is tridiagonal. So if the matrix is tridiagonal, even if this is very, very large, they can still solve it efficiently. They can still do a Cholesky on it efficiently. However, then you have to think, you see, each iteration involves getting a new conjugate gradient method and solving this whole problem again and again and again. So if they're going to build up to a very, very large problem, they're solving many, many, many subproblems. But they can solve these subproblems very, very efficiently because the Cholesky is very fast. So they're depending on the fact that they can use the Morey-Sorensen problem very efficiently to solve these subproblems. So that right away tells you that they can't get very much accuracy. Because if they ever try to get high accuracy for these subproblems, then each subproblem is going to be too expensive and it doesn't make sense. So in some sense, they're doing an inexact Newton-type approach to inside the subproblem. So that's an outline of their method. So it's based on, again, it's just based on getting these Lanczos vectors and getting the tridiagonalization. So let's look at a bit of duality for semi-definite programming. This is the going back. I'm going to just put an equality here just to make life easy so we can just forget about the sign for a while. It doesn't really change the theory. And let's look at Lagrangian duality for this problem. Here's the Lagrangian over here. I've added the constraint. I put squares on it, added it to the objective with the Lagrange multiplier lambda. And I'm taking a look at the Lagrangian dual. So this is a max min of the Lagrangian. The inside minimization here is unconstrained. So if the inner minimization is unconstrained and we're taking a maximum here, we can go ahead and take the derivative and set the derivative equal to zero. The inside minimization is going to be as long as we have convexity in X. So we have to, again, maintain convexity in X. So we have an inside constraint. This H of lambda is just the derivative setting this gradient equal to zero. So we define H of lambda this way. And we get an interesting dual problem that looks like this. Using the Wolf dual. So you add the gradient being zero as a constraint and out pops this. Then you substitute using the gradient equals zero into the Lagrangian. You get this function, out pops this interesting dual. And this is semi-definite programming, except there's a positive definite constraint here. This is a sort of an interesting phenomenon here. Because of the Hart case, you need positive definiteness as the constraint. There's the definition for H. So this is one dual. And we use this information in the algorithm. There's some other duals. So we saw Mike use homogenization. Homogenization is a very useful tool in these problems. We homogenize the problem by adding a y sub 0. So we add the constraint y 0 squared equals 1. Now we're going to take the Lagrangian dual of this problem and see what happens for this problem. So this is my one proof, except it's more than two lines. So I won't go through it. Just show you the punchline at the end. Actually, there's a second slide. So this is the punchline at the end by going through the details of this over here. We get that the optimal value of the trust region subproblem is equal to this, max min of this, and then we can take this term and put it inside of a matrix. It's a quadratic form in Z, where we take Z to be the vector of X and Y0. So Z is over here. So we've got a problem in one dimension larger. That's where the homogenization variable went. And we have this matrix D, which is one dimension larger. So this problem, I think, is very interesting because you define K of T in this way. It's S squared plus 1 times the smallest eigenvalue of this matrix minus T. The trust region subproblem has now become a totally unconstrained problem. Just maximize this function. And this function here is concave. And it's defined everywhere. It's a very nice function. It's the one, well, with the inequality, you'd have to add an extra condition on, this is the with equality. Yeah, you'd have to add an extra condition on the, but you get unconstrained as well. Yeah, so try to remember what you need for the inequality one. You'd need it's a minor condition for the sign, but I'm sorry, I just don't remember just now. Yeah, but you don't really lose anything by going to the equality case because your optimum is either in the interior or on the boundary. So you don't, and then so all you do is check as you're going along whether you're going to be in the interior, and you jump into the interior. Otherwise, you just stay on the boundary. Okay. So you can change this problem, and this maybe it comes out better here. What would happen to the inequality? So you can change a minimum eigenvalue problem to a semi-definite program. The matrix D is greater or equal to lambda I. And in this case, you would have lambda less or equal to zero. That would give you the inequality constraint problem. If you had an extra constraint to your lambda less or equal to zero. Because the lambda is going to be your optimal Lagrange multiplier in the end. So here's a semi-definite pair, and Slater's condition is satisfied for both. So here's another way, and strict complementarity. You can show strict complementarity. So here's another way of showing that we have a stable problem. So let's take a look at a picture of this K. So this is what it looks like. So this is in the easy case. So what's easier than finding a maximum for a nice function like this, right? I mean, there's so many methods that you could use, right? But what's hiding, of course, is you have to evaluate the function. And evaluating the function means you evaluate an eigenvalue. So that's what's hiding here. So there is work involved. But you know, you can do line search, you can do bisection, you can do Fibonacci, you can do Yinyu's speed as a way of speeding up the line search. There's lots of different ways of doing this. So that's the easy case. What does it look in the hard case? Well, the hard case just has an extra little complication. So this is the case one of the hard case. So you can see, starting at this point, from here on, it's a straight line, slope minus 1. At this point, it's non-differentiable. Otherwise, it's really unchanged. So this is the easy form, the easy part of the hard case. And the hard case, case 2, looks like this. So this is not a straight line. This has a bit of a curve in it. You could have more of a curve here. But this is slope minus 1. And you need to find this point at the top here. Okay? But still, if you think about it, if you'd ever take a Newton step here, I mean, you can really do some nice geometry to speed up convergence rather than slow it down. Right? So you can do all sorts of very trivial type of linear interpolation and get this optimum very, very quickly. So this is the hard case. This is what supposedly in literature is the hard case that you cannot find accurately. So the only thing that you need to know is be able to get the eigenvalue accurately. Okay, so you're saying once you have the eigenvalue accurately, can you find, you mean in the hard case, can you solve the least squares problem accurately? Maurice Sorensen, so that's, again, you can, so the regular least squares problem is an ill-posed problem. So if you had a least squares, if you had a least squares problem just with a general matrix, yes, it's an ill-posed problem. However, this is a least squares problem where you know the optimum is within a ball. So if you do the error analysis for it, small perturbations, yes, it can throw you off, right? But it can't throw you off very far, right? The worst they can throw you off is a length of 2s, 2 times the radius. So, and then, you know, you have to say how close, you know, it depends on what you want to analyze. If you want to do a backward error analysis for the algorithm, you can have a backward stable algorithm because it has to be on the boundary. So, does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, so I'm running out of time, so the second half of my talk will have to be not given. So there's a whole bunch of little tricks that we do to take advantage of these functions that are involved. So we have, just like the Maurice Sorensen, to find the maximum, we have to differentiate this function, but we don't just solve k prime of t equals 0. We take a reciprocal as well, so that Newton's method really flies, so that this is what the derivative looks like. But we don't solve that problem. We do a reciprocal, so we get something very, very nice and smoothed out, and where Newton's method works very quickly. So we have the same type of phenomenon as the Maurice Sorensen, that Newton's method is very quick. But there's several other things that we do to take advantage of the structure. So I can't go through all of them, but I think several of them, I wish I could, several of them are very interesting. One of them is a new type of Newton's method, which is a new paper by Benisriel, and I forget the second author, Levin, Benisriel Levin. And what they do is instead of doing the Newton's method on X, what they do is they take a target, take a horizontal line and they subtract, let's say call it M, and they subtract f of x minus M, and then they solve this new problem and they move the target depending on the information they get from x. So we use this. We also use something called triangular, so this nice concave function, we use triangle interpolation. So we're trying to find the maximum, so we have the derivatives that maybe we did a couple of iterations. We have a point here and here. So we have the derivatives. So we always have this point. So this point automatically gives us an upper bound. So we're always getting an interval, an upper bound and lower bound. This will give us lower bounds. That gives us an upper bound. So this upper bound, of course, if we had the hard case with that triangle, this is a very good approximation. So that's one of the techniques. And here's another little interesting technique called a vertical cut. It's a little trick. So suppose we had two points, one over here and one over here from previous iterations. Okay? And this one is bigger than this one. So during iterations, we always have the derivative. So we take the slope over here, and we take the horizontal line over here. Then we take the vertical cut, means we go down here. Means the optimum always has to be to the left of this point. So we're always reducing the t interval as well as the lambda interval and the others. So this is an interesting trick that for free always reduces the interval of uncertainty. And this really cuts down a lot of iterations. So without doing any iteration at all, it just cuts down the interval. We also do inverse interpolation. And just to give you an idea of what that looks like, and because these things are almost linear, you can see the accuracy you get from the inverse interpolation. It really flies. It's like just as fast as Newton's method. It goes rather quickly. So to finish off, I'll give you something hot off the press, just made this morning. Of course, we have to improve on somebody, so we took the... Whoops. Does it show anything? So we took the Moray Sorensen. Charles did this yesterday, last night. Get it done in time, right? We took, this is Moray Sorensen, and this is the problem size, and this is our algorithm. So this is the Cholesky. So we took the density decreased as n increased. So the density was 1 over 10 times n log n. Okay. So the density decreased, and then just to make Moray Sorensen work hard, we gave it log n dense rows. Because it's Cholesky. Log n, right? So as you can see, Moray Sorensen really just disappears into nowhere. And we also solved some problems last night, 40,000, 60,000 variables using MATLAB with hundreds of thousand non-zeros. And you could just see it go boom, 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 six iterations. And the accuracy we get is 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 15 on the average. And we asked Moray Sorensen for 10 to the minus 12. They claimed they got 10 to the minus 12, but on the average it was 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 10. So even though they just couldn't do it. Yeah. So, okay, I went a little longer than that. Thank you.